We know what you're thinking. I just want jeans that look great, feel great, and hold up. At Ariat, we've been doing some thinking too. We're thinking about fit that moves with you, no matter where the ride takes you. Durability that stands up to hard work, harder play, and comfort that never quits. And all this thinking, it's really just about more living. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find your Ariat jeans at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Hang in there, it is.
That's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
Welcome back to The Smiley Show, where Smiley and I were just having an off-camera discussion about dad bedtimes. And we said, you know what? It's off-season. We're doing one episode a week. Let's just take it on the show. So where were we, Smiley? Refresh, jog my memory a little bit here.
Well, I was just saying to you how tricky sometimes it is as far as just how long it might take to get Anna Carter down for bed. And it's kind of been my role here, you know, for the last 3 weeks is, you know, I'm full-time getting Anna Carter to bed mode. But really for, gosh, it was, man, a good 5 months, 6 months where she did not want to do anything with dad at bedtime. Like we play all the way up until bedtime. But if I even come close to stepping through her door, she's like, daddy, no. And so it was always such a deflating feeling because, you know, for a year, I'm the one putting her down with the bottle at night. I don't know what age that was, but I felt like that I was nailing bedtime. Like that was what I did. And then all of a sudden she's like, no, 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 only mom. And so nice to be back in the fold, but also
there he is.
It kind of takes a second to get her down because we kind of go all over the place, to be honest, between storytelling, books. Yeah.
It's so eventful. Cyclical because I remember that it, same exact way for me until our second arrived, our baby girl Kadek arrived, and then Walker. It was like I was the guy who always put down Walker. And Walker, you know, what's a good word to use here? I manipulate is a little strong. Like he knew how to work Amanda for sure. Mm-hmm. And so she would spend a long time in that room. And then when I finally took over and I walked out of that room in like 3.5 minutes, it was like I was
you
like
got Bob Knight coming in. You know, he's
hey, look at this guy. How do you do it? You know,
no
like the
silly
first
business.
Time it was an audible gasp. She's like, how'd you do that? I'm like, well, you know, when you got it, you got it.
Yeah.
But now we've kind of hit a regression period. And it's like, dad, you're no longer in the mix. I figured out that you knew how to get me to bed fast. And that's not how I want my bedtime to go. So Amanda's back in. And this has been now compounded by the fact that, as was the case when I was a young child, we are entering a big dinosaur phase. Loves dinosaurs. And of course, me having that soft spot of being a dinosaur kid, you know, I'm trying to encourage it, right? So I got him this like prehistoric alligator. It's called a Purosaurus. It was like one of the largest alligators that ever walked on Earth. I think it was in South America. And this thing has like a row of daggers along its back. And so, you know, it's like, hey, let's go to bed. Do you want to use your stuffy T-Rex to bed? No, no, no. I want the alligator. And then it's like, okay, can we put you down? It's like, no, Amanda, you have to sleep next to me. It's like, can we put the alligator outside the bed? No. So what happens is Amanda ends up laying in bed for like 90 minutes with an alligator toy digging into her back until she can successfully escape. So that's where we're at with bedtime.
Well, the good news right now with Anna Carter is that she's still in a crib. You know, she doesn't realize that she can get out. Luckily enough for us, I think if she was a second kid, she would know that she can get out of the crib. But because there's no other big girl beds or big boy beds around, she just thinks that that's what's normal. So we're trying to keep her in the crib as long as we can until she climbs out because she could easily do it. She's a monkey, man.
That's Walker. He his first night in the bed was the night that Kadek arrived, which is an insane week because he figured he could get out of his crib and then we try to pack and play. He could get out of his pack and play. At that point, we had really nowhere else to go. Just, all right, it's time to go to the bed. And then it was, Kadek's arrived a week early and now we're just doing everything at the same time. Joys of fatherhood.
Huh? I like similar to your Purosaurus. Is that what it was?
Purosaurus. Okay. Strange name for it. I don't know who named that.
Kind of a little sus, by the way.
A little sus. little sus. First couple times I read the name, I was like, am I saying this right? Am I getting this right?
It didn't feel right when I said it. I'll tell you that.
Like, we're talking about the largest alligator that walked Earth, and we decided to call that a Purosaurus. Like, I think we could have, I would have had at least four or five names ahead of that on the list. But, you know, whoever, maybe it was like, you know, doctor, some scientist named Purr that discovered it. I'm sure there's a good reason for it.
Where I was going is that I have to tuck in her baby and the giraffe and her. And if I don't tuck in one of those, then she starts yelling, "Dad," you know, like the Stewie Griffin Family Guy, which is mom, mommy, mommy, mama, mommy. Have you ever seen that? You kind of get that going, whether it's depends on who's in the cycle, whether it's a mom or dad. And lately it's been me. And so I have to come back and then, oh, my tummy hurt. It's always something. She's playing the system and she's really good at it.
Once they figure out how to negotiate, it's a tough scene because you think you're smarter than your child and until you realize I passed down my negotiating genes to this child and now it's me versus me and that's not a good scenario.
She's like, it's like, who taught you that? Oh, wait.
Wait a second.
Hold on. Me, I did.
I have a great stuffed ankylosaurus I'm going to give him, but I'm not trying to give him too many gifts early on. Like I did it in the wrong order. I should have given him the Ankylosaurus first. He would have slept with that. And then he could have gotten the Purosaurus for Christmas. But listen, just a mistake, just a dad mistake. We learn. I'll say this to segue from this to, we're not quite going to go on golf yet because I had to just give you some sort of congratulations. Like I'm all time high now. Did we get rid of Brian Kelly? Is this happening?
It's done. It's done. My favorite thing I've been sending to all my friends. This is, hold on, here we go. Let's see. It's a great meme. Very similar to the Pope as they flash the smoke up. You got Death Valley. Check this out.
Yes. Yes.
It's done. It's, I mean, sad. Dude, we've been embarrassed too many times. And Kelly, I hope he goes on to have a great career as a politician or in TV. But it's time for that guy to not be coaching college football anymore.
Does he have like the lowest approval rating of any modern college football coach? I don't know of anyone who's like, yes, I really like Brian Kelly.
You follow him for like 3.5-4 years, like you do. You see every press conference, you read everything he says. He's a CEO. He speaks awesome. You know, it going from Coach O to him, it was like, oh my gosh, we have an adult in the room that knows how to speak, communicate. And so everybody's just wowed by all the big words that he could say. And we're like, this is awesome. We got somebody, a big guy in the room that can control it. And then after a while, you're like, wait, he just says the same thing. It's really nothing. He doesn't ever say anything. It's just a whole lot of nothing. And it's like, oh, we got to fix it. You know, and it never gets fixed. Nothing ever gets fixed. And constantly on the football field, when you watch him, directors of ESPN or whoever it is, they're really good about making sure that they show Kelly as much as possible because he is an angry elf on the sideline every single game. It's just hard to root for the guy. He's never has a smile on his face. He's always just giving whoever, like whether it's a quarterback, like players, he just looks like he's not fun to play for.
Well, and that's the thing is that the ass chewings, so to speak, that Nick Saban was so famous for. When it's Nick Saban, it kind of carries a little bit of weight. When it's Brian Kelly, it doesn't have quite the same ring to it. For me, I mean, I just feel like
you just need there wasn't enough good to outweigh it. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, all those acts, any act like that, that is, you know, difficult and abrasive, it works if you're winning. The moment you stop winning, you know, it's kind of time. And I feel like that's the story of Brian Kelly.
It's a perfection thing with Saban, and because he wants the best out of his team and to be able to dominate the opponent. We never dominated an opponent. We won games by just outlasting them with talent. And that's basically all of our wins in the Brian Kelly era were that. We just were more talented than you. And any of our big losses, it was all just basically just coaching when we had talent that was similar to the other team. And I thought like they had
much more talent than we did last night. But man, it was fun. You know, the Aggies, shout out to the Aggies. If you're an Aggie fan, thank you so much. big, you know, most years I really want to beat you guys, but shout out to you guys for absolutely taking us down.
Every once in a while, a rival gives you a nice, there was also that nice sort of, you know, what goes around, comes back around situation where the first guy that Brian Kelly fired was a strength and conditioning coach that ended up at A&M and that Mike Elko referenced, you know, in terms of the key piece of beating LSU late in games.
That guy only won three different national championships with three different coaches.
I'll say this, Smiley. A lot of people were kind of firing up the James Franklin rumor train. I don't love that for you.
No, I feel like, oh God, if we fired Franklin, send me the North Carolina visor.
Yeah. Well, I think you got to look for a guy with proven NFL experience, a guy who's looking to build an NFL program at the collegiate level. And, I'd really hate to see Bill Belichick go with what he's built in North Carolina. But, if he's going to LSU, I think I could handle that. I'd say, hey, get you a little purple visor. Good luck.
What if Miss Terry liked an offer she got?
Wow. Wow.
Not saying it would ever happen, but
wow. Wait a second. That did not even cross my brain yet. Can you imagine a Nick Saban LSU return, like the final chapter?
I thought you were about to say, can you imagine Nick Saban? She's like, yeah, I actually can. It was awesome.
that's what I'm saying. It's like, of all the places that he would go, right? Like he really couldn't or shouldn't maybe go to any other LSU or any other SEC team rather. And it would feel weird fits a different place in the country. It feels like he's kind of an SEC guy, but that's the one place where it's like, I've coached there before. I won a national championship there before. Why not go make that the final ride?
I mean, it'd be amazing. It's not going to happen. That would shock me. Once you live down in Jupiter for a year and a half and play golf down there and have the easy life of, I wouldn't say easy life. TV's not an easy life, but it's way less complicated than what he was doing.
Yeah. 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 Well, let's see what Mysteri has to say about that. That's good. That's a good little warm up. This is what we do in the off season. We catch up because we're only doing this once a week. So we get to talk a little dadding, talk a little college football. And then a place that I'll start here now, Smiley, I'm going to bring this into golf, but it's the sports news of the week. It's just mind blowing. The whole NBA gambling, you know, fiasco, whatever you want to call it. I'm just going to give the sort of the headline piece of the news where there are two separate things happening. There's like the Terry Rozier, if that's even how you say his last name. Fixing is not the right word, but it's effectively saying, hey, I'm going to bet the under on various prop bets associated with me because I'm going to pull myself out of this game with injury.
Someone call it fixing. Point.
That is a form of fixing.
I'm not saying that's the definition, but right. I think that may have actually just been a definition of fixing.
Well, and then there's the whole separate investigation that involves NBA coaches and former players and assistants, but that is focused on rigged card games, right? So we're going to set that aside for a moment because I think that what has happened here for a lot of sports, we saw friend of the show Adam Schefter report on a memo that the NFL sent out to all the teams as a reminder on gambling policies, is put a lot of sports on notice. You and I were talking as we prepared for the subject about Rob Manfred being asked about this on the baseball side and saying, hey, look, none of these leagues wanted gambling to come into their sport. But it was something that got legalized. It was sort of this necessary evil, probably is one way you could say it. But I think for them, it's if it's going to happen and we're looking at these different gambling operators, there is a net positive for us of working with them to identify databases, information on our gamblers to make sure that we know if someone is gambling on this that has a material impact on the outcome of our games. And so there's this sort of like, hey, this is where we are as a society, for better or worse. And what impact does this have on games that we love? So specific to this podcast, right, talking about golf, I did a little bit of light research here, just looking back at what can we remember in recent memory or just even in distant history of gambling and golf being intertwined in a potentially negative way. And so a lot of this comes out of things that surfaced in the year 2023. There was the book that Billy Walters published, Gambler, Secrets from a Life at Risk, where he alleges that Phil Mickelson called him from Medina during the 2012 Ryder Cup, attempting to place a $400,000 wager on the Americans to win the cup, which good on Phil for not placing that, because this was, of course, the miracle Medina, where the Europeans came back. One of the greatest comebacks in Ryder Cup history.
Did you read that book?
I did not read that book, but I read a lot of the excerpts from that book.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Be an interesting read, right?
It would be an interesting read. I mean, I think it's one of those things where how much of an axe does Billy Walters have to grind, right? Like, does he have anything to lose by writing this book? Probably not, if he's gone through all this sort of legal stuff already, but there is a little bit of, I'd like to maintain a public image. So how much of that is Billy giving you his spin, and how much of that is really factual? Probably an interesting read. Well,
let us know in the comments, folks. If you've read the book, give us a review, you know, a little review out of five.
Spark notes.
Yeah.
Us.
Yeah. Just let us know if we should read it.
So there's that, of course, but that was an allegation. Nothing proved factually there yet. Also in 2023, two Korn Ferry Tour pros, Jake Stiano and Vince India, were suspended for 3 and 6 months respectively for violating betting rules within the tour's integrity program. Now, India, as far as I can see or find via research, never spoke on that. But Jake Stiano, the 3 month suspension.
I don't know who that is. Jake Stiano?
Well, it's funny, bring us full circle. After the suspension, he played on the PGA Tour Americas this last year, made 16 starts and finished 34th in the Fortinet Cup standings. Only the top 10 earned their Korn Ferry Tour cards. So he's still playing, but on the PGA Tour Americas. So Jake went on Ryan French's podcast, you probably better know as Monday Q Info on Twitter.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And discussed, and he was suspended 3 months for a total of $116.20 of bets. He placed a $25 bet on Bryson DeChambeau to make birdie on a par five in a PGA Tour event in 2021. And then three other bets on DeChambeau during that match he played with Brooks Koepka. So he said, this is his quote on the podcast: "I understand the principles. I understand you can't bet. They laid it out perfectly. I didn't deny gambling. I've accepted my punishment. It is what it is. Fair or not, people can argue that, but one of my biggest things is I want to make sure other guys understand exactly what happened so they don't make the same mistake, because it could be career altering." So interesting perspective from a guy who really didn't gamble that much, and the tour came down very hard on him via the policy they had. Marty Fish, this was an interesting one. This was at the 2023 American Century Championship in Tahoe, the celeb event you've covered the last 2 years. He was kind of in the running there, contending with Steph Curry coming down the stretch.
I remember this.
Spectator makes a bird call noise in the middle of his backswing. He snap hooks it.
Is it the same bird call guy from the Webb Simpson deal at Olympic? Same guy?
It's funny you say that, because that was my first guess. It's like, is this bird guy? He's popping around. He's maintaining he's extending his 15 seconds of fame.
Why a bird call? You know,
I would have never thought anything of it until Marty later goes on Ryan Russillo's podcast and says he found out that the heckler had bet on Steph Curry, and a little bit of foreshadowing here, wondered why something like this hadn't happened more often in the game of golf. And so then a few months later, 2023 BMW Championship, Max Homa was paired with Chris Kirk. Chris Kirk plays first. A fan shouts at him to leave his 18-foot birdie putt short. And then in the middle of Max Homa's putting stroke, yells at him to yank his 5-foot birdie putt. Max makes it. They exchange words. After the round, Max is asked about it. He said that they gathered from the guy's friend. They had $3 riding on that bet. For that birdie putt. And Max said his quote was, "I love that people can gamble on golf, but this is one thing I'm worried about." And then just to kind of close these, and then I want to pose a series of questions to you. But then a week later, Rory McIlroy and John Rahm were asked at the 2023 Tour Championship about that Max incident. Rory says, "We've talked about this at the board and the pack level for a few years, and it's a bit of a slippery slope, because I don't think there's any, maybe basketball and you can sit courtside, but I think it's a different environment where people can really affect the play out here. So look, as long as it's policed the right way, and as long as there's measures put in place for hopefully things like what happened to Max Homa last Saturday not to happen, we're all for people out here having a good time, being able to put something on an outcome. But as long as they don't feel like they can come here and influence that outcome, I think that's important." Rahm went on to say, "I think the tour maybe should look into it, because you don't want it to get out of hand. It's very easy in golf. If you want to affect somebody, you're so close. You can yell at the wrong time, and it's very easy for that to happen. I feel like we hear it every single round. That happens way more often than you guys may hear. I mean, it's very, very present. And golf spectators are very close. And even if they're not directly talking to you, they're close enough to where if they say their buddy, I bet you $10 he's going to miss it. You hear it, so it happens more often than you think." So, Smiley, here's where I want to start. It is just on the competitor side, right? Because this is the whole issue that's stemming from the NBA situation, is that we know that you all played money games dang near every time you had a practice round set. I mean, that
that's
is
a good point. Yeah. I mean, gambling is a big part of golf, right? That's
so, but did you ever feel a worry or concern that a player's gambling habit was bleeding into the actual competition?
Did I ever think a player's gambling habit was bleeding into the competition?
Like the real part of the competition, not, you know, hammer quarters you're playing with the guys or not a nice out, you know, like when we're getting to the actual tournament, some guy's gambling habit was having a material impact on a tour event. Did you ever have a worry like that?
Where the player is gambling out on the course?
No, I mean, just any sort of effectively what I'm trying to understand is that there are clearly a number of guys. There was Jonte Porter now has been banned for life in the NBA. You have Terry Rozier. There are other guys.
Oh, you're saying, do you think golfers could ever fix?
Did you ever have any sort of worry in that direction?
No, golf, it seems, I mean, crazier things will happen, but it seems like that would never be a worry of mine for a player because it's so cutthroat, you know, like these guys have guaranteed salaries on the PGA Tour. Mm-hmm. You don't, you know, you're fine. Every single shot is so important. Every week is so important. Maybe if you, I guess a scenario that you can play out in your head, if somebody locks up their card, there's no worry about them losing their card. That would be the player that you could say that would be more susceptible to like, no, these guys take a lot of pride in what they do. And I don't think the five families are necessarily quite into the golf scene quite yet. We talk about the mob, so I don't see it. And when you kind of mentioned too the rules and regulations and that the PGA Tour has, it's clearly black and white. When you just talked about, you know, a Korn Ferry Tour player, Jake, I can't even remember
Stiano.
His name. Yeah, Stiano. Just, I mean, $25 bets. I think most people would say like that's a very low wager, like a non-effective wager that anybody should have any concern, whether that should have any effect on any outcome or if you got a tip. You know, your biggest worry would be is if a player has like inside information. Mm-hmm. And that's when they're gambling. And so a $25 wager wouldn't necessarily sound the alarm bells, but there's the PGA Tour has very, very strict rules and regulations. It's something that's you got to sign, you know, before every single year, you know, what you're signed up for when it comes to just the gambling regulations that they have. But you also think about the finances that the PGA Tour have, the networks have, even just players having individual deals with these gambling companies too. That's constantly something that's being put in front of consumers, you know, hey, if they get, you know, if you hit the green here, these are the odds, you know, so it's constantly being floated on broadcasts. It's being talked about to even with the PGA Tour, they have their own individual deals with different gambling outlets too. So it's one of those tough situations because there's so much money in gambling that there's the gambling companies are spending with these different leagues that it puts the players in really tough spots because really they are the ones that get the negative effects from consumers gambling on me versus Charlie. And we're the ones that have to deal with the negative backlash of playing bad that day. It's like, hey, you suck. It's like, I put you in my lineup or I had you head to head. So really the players get the backlash of it all. And I guess it's important because the more eyeballs that watch the sport, the better. And unfortunately, sometimes that means gambling and, and that's what keeps people's attention as right or wrong as that is. It's true.
We've had gambling companies sponsor our show at various intervals. And so we're not here, you know, as some sort of moral police saying, you know, what's right or what's wrong. I just think more so in thinking about the specific topic and this piece of news, the first place my brain goes to is, should I be worried about this on a golf level? And I think you've done a good job of like segmenting this of what potential places of worry could we have? And the first one, which you stated, I think is the most important, which is these guys are they're contractors. They are not on a guaranteed salary, at least in most leagues. But I mean, the ones that are playing every week in, week out to keep their tour cards, even if a guy was in deep with some, you know, bookie, it doesn't really behoove that bookie to have that guy play bad and play his way off the tour if he's trying to use him as some sort of gambling pawn. There's no math here that results in have player play bad intentionally, in my opinion, at least from as far as what I can see. And so and these guys are on a week in, week out basis, needing to continue to play good to make the money they need to earn. If they're playing poorly, that really doesn't help them in any way, shape, or form. I also think, too, that where we started this topic is there is a sort of ethos of the game of golf of even if it's a friendly dollar wager, like gambling's been a part of golf since the game was invented, right? And it's always about betting on yourself, right? I mean, every time I go out and play Hope Valley with the buddies, like we have a game going and it's never like, okay, let me hedge this here so I can bet against myself so I can throw this thing. It's like, it's always, hey, put money on yourself to play good. And it feels like that is the ethos at a tour pro level and these practice rounds, things like that. So I think that it's hard to see guys changing a mindset or mentality away from that, given that their whole life it's been that sort of the way they're playing the game. The third thing is the fan thing, which I do have serious worries about. I mean, I'm actually kind of surprised in going back and doing this research that since 2023, there hasn't really been any sort of material issue. I did see a couple things at 2024 in the US Open. Someone told Bryson they had him to like shoot, to post a score under 70.5. They had like Victor Hovland to make a cut. They like yelled it to him across the ropes, something like that. But nothing that was as egregious as what we saw at the 2023 BMW Championship. But as gambling does become more and more ingrained in this sport, in every sport, really, do you have concerns either that have been voiced by tour pros you talk to or other people in the space that hey, this hasn't been a thing yet, but this might start to be a thing pretty soon?
Well, I think the fans can get up close and personal and can affect play. So that definitely would be an issue that you would be concerned about. But also, you got to think about this, like, if you put yourself in that scenario as a fan, kind of awkward to try to do that, right? You know, if you're really close up and you got all these people around you, and next thing you know, you're yelling at somebody's backswing, dude, everybody's going to look at you. It's going to be the most awkward you've ever felt in your entire life. What are you going to do? Just run? You know, it's also a peer pressure of wow, that's the stupidest thing I've ever done. Like, you can't just get away with it. Everybody's going to know who it was. It's golf. Like, it's not like everybody's talking to where you can just get away with, yelling something stupid. So yes, in theory, you could see that it could potentially happen, but I don't see it being just this widespread issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's, I do in some ways, it's funny coming off our discussion about Bethpage. It does connect back to like, how do we handle game growth? Like, does this connect back to, there wasn't a ton of shame from some things we heard at Bethpage. So you wonder how far that's gone. And that's my only concern in that direction. But the hope is that, hey, if you have a bunch of people who you're bringing to the game and you're saying, this is the way the game goes, this is how you act as a fan, this is how you play the game when you're kind of wagering with your friends. The hope is that those things become ingrained and then you don't get the type of person that has no shame and is going out there yelling at people. And,
it's an individual sport. You know, there's so many different players playing every single week. You got teams that constantly they're players or I should say spectators are cheering for or against. I mean, with so many different individual players playing, it's gambling is the only way that could really make its way into this to make it to where it's a problem.
Yeah, well, we'll see. It's something obviously everyone's going to keep an eye on now. But I do really, I know we just touched on it briefly here, and we'll see what comes in the future. But I do really feel good about the state of professional golf relative to other leagues in terms of this permeating it and becoming a problem. I think that there's not a ton to worry about.
Well, quick question. Did the $25 bet hit? Do we know?
They didn't say that in the report. I was actually hoping for a little more detail on the like.
Was it like a parlay?
the one thing I'll say about Jake Stiano is like, if you're live betting the match, let's get you some help, buddy.
If you're live betting on Brooks Koepka, if I was caught in a situation like this, it would have been much better if I had just hit the bets and had maybe they're like $200 bets. Like, man, guys absolutely throwing some heavy cash out there. Like, guy's serious about what he does and he's hitting his bets. So you get a little street cred from the golf audience. Like, all right, all of a sudden I like this guy. You know, he's put $200 on Bryson to drive the green at the seventh hole. I like that. I like that. This guy.
Yeah. Well, listen, he's on a Corn Fairy Tour budget. I think we'll give him a pass, but it's certainly interesting. Smiley. I'm certainly
not shaming a $25 bet. Here, I'm not going to do that. We're not shaming anybody. It's throwing a little wager out on a game. It's just a shame that he did it in something that he probably didn't know he couldn't do it in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he owned up to it, and here he is still playing golf post suspension. So good on you, Jake Stiano. And that's what I have for you on the gambling front, Smiley. We're once again going to abruptly transition to the next portion of the show, which is an interview that I'm really excited to put out for you with Mason Howe, a guy that is one of the rising stars on the amateur golf circuit, still in high school, still 18 years old, not enrolling at the University of Georgia until 2026.
So at the NCAAs, they would have tees that you could get on the first tee, and it would say like at NCAA some years, and some years it also would say like don't bet on it. So as we transfer here to Mason Howell heading to Georgia, he'll get those tees and he'll know, hey, don't bet on it.
That's an exceptional segue there, Smiley. The story I was going to use to tee up this interview is still one of my favorite stories associated with a tour pro thus far in terms of our media coverage, which is to say that when I was showing up for the first time at Cypress Point for the Friday practice rounds, the shuttle driver was very confused, dropped me off somewhere where I should not have been, and I like walked.
How do you get confused? I mean, it's 17-mile drive, one road.
I have no clue why he dropped me off like at a service road that dumped out on the backside of three green, little par three there at Cypress Point. So I started working my way up the right side of three and kind of working back down the left side of two, the par five. And I show up and it's the entire United States team playing tensums. They're all playing all at shot. They're gearing up. And so I the first five shots I watched hit were all guys kind of hitting their approaches into the par five second. And Mason's was the final one, and he hooped it for Albatross. I was like, okay, this guy just won the 2025 USAM. He hooped it for Albatross, went on to watch him make birdies, back-to-back birdies at 15 and 16 on Saturday in singles play. He is the real deal, Smiley. And I just wonder, you know, we taped this conversation a couple weeks ago, but anything you can recall in terms of just having a conversation with a guy who's only 18 but already has a ton of maturity and a ton of golf game, what the expectations could be for him?
I'm just jealous. I wish I was that age. I wish I was about to be heading to Georgia. I wish I, you know, was heading to play in the World Am or whatever it's called. I wish, you know, I had won the USA. There's a lot of jealousy, honestly, with Mason, but yeah, it was a really great interview with Mason. He has a great personality, has so much to look forward to. Incredible start to his amateur career, and things sure look like he's in a good spot heading next fall.
It is not bad to be Mason Howell right now. So with that said, let's get right to it. Smiley's conversation with Mason.
All right, guys, welcome back to another episode of the Smiley Show. We have the U.S. Amateur winner, Mason Howell, joining us today. Mason, buddy, I can't imagine going from winning the U.S. Amateur at an amazing golf course like the Olympic Club to qualifying for the Walker Cup team at Cypress Point to then somehow going back to having to sit in a classroom. Like, that to me had to be like the biggest drop off of adrenaline of all time when you walk back into your high school. Is that fair to say that's the truth?
Yeah, no, definitely. I don't enjoy it at all. I've tried to get out of school as much as possible since I've been home, but yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I mean, how much has your life changed? Of course, we're going to get into all the details from the USAM and the Walker Cup, but I mean, just how much has your life changed at home walking through the high school halls? Everybody, I'm sure, recognizes you from, of course, I mean, I'm sure you grew up with all these people, but I'm sure their parents are now like, say, hey, do you mind signing this for my dad or something like that? You get much of that?
Yeah, no, I'll get some of that, especially when I go to like football games on Friday nights. And but it's Thomasville is such a great town, everybody knows everybody, so
sure.
Yeah, but no, it's awesome, but it's also been a complete turnaround and change of my life.
I mean, what has that media storm been like since you gotten home? I imagine you really hadn't had a ton of time to just sit down and celebrate with your family or friends. Have you had a chance to do any of that yet?
So when I got back from the AM, I kind of set off like a week. I don't think I touched a club for a week and just knocked out all the media stuff that I had to knock out. And then Yeah. Fortunately, at the Walker Cup, a lot of the media stuff was on site. But sure. Yeah, no, it's definitely been a whirlwind, and things are kind of settling down before I leave again for the World Am.
Yeah, I haven't met you in person, Mason, but from what it looks like on TV, it seems like you're a pretty tall guy. How tall are you?
6'4".
Whoa. All right. So we just play golf? Do we quit basketball at some point? Are we playing sports?
Yeah, I played basketball pretty much throughout middle school, but yeah. Got pretty tired of not being able to play golf. Like, basketball is a winter sport, and after practice, I didn't really have any time to play golf, and yeah, and I was probably sitting on the bench a little more than I liked.
I was about to say, do you think you could still be playing basketball, or do you think would you be making that starting five, or at least getting some minutes?
Well, in middle school, it was kind of on and off, so I was like one of those kids that I would rather be playing on like the B team, get more playing time.
Love it. Love that. All right, so you're in Thomasville, is that right?
Yeah.
All right, where is that for the people that don't know where Thomasville, Georgia is?
It's I'd say it's 40 minutes north of Tallahassee, Florida. So we're right on the Georgia-Florida line, and like 4 hours south of Atlanta, west of Valdosta. But it's where Harris English grew up, and Hudson Swafford obviously grew up in Tallahassee. So it's a lot of good golfers have come out of this area.
So Harris English is obviously a player that we've had on this podcast, and Harris has talked about his time, I believe, is it Glen Arvin Country Club? Mm-hmm. Is that where he kind of grew up playing some golf? I know Harris was kind of getting around a little bit in high school, going up and playing up at Baylor, but still, what's this golf course like, and why is it produce some top level talent?
Yeah. Harris started his junior career at Glen Arvin. But it's all thanks to Bill Conley. He was the head pro at Glen Arvin for a long time, and now he's director of golf. But he's been all of our golf coaches. He was Harris's golf coach before he went up to Baylor. But he just like loves junior golf. He's so open to having as many juniors out there going to the back of the range. Like on any given Saturday, the back of the range is just packed with juniors practicing, and then you'll see middle schoolers out on the course walking together playing. And I think that's a big part. And we've had just a lot of great Division I players, and we've had great female golfers. Megan Schofield won the Women's Am in 23, and yeah, it's been a great place for me to grow up and play, because it's always stiff competition. Every time I know out there, I'll be able to pick up a good game.
Mason, catch me up and those listening and watching this on 2025. Get me to the beginning of this year on just your entire journey, basically, to that point, because you're obviously a player who's found a lot this summer. But up until that point, was there confidence from yourself heading into this year that this could be a breakout year? You're committed currently to go to University of Georgia, which that isn't exactly an easy scholarship to get to play for Chris Hacker of Georgia. So just catch us up before this big run you've had this summer.
Yeah, no. You know, ever since I committed, I feel like it's kind of freed me up, honestly, to just get after it. Like playing college golf is obviously a lot of junior golfers' big goal, and getting a big D1 scholarship. So that was like a weight off my shoulders. And making the turn into the year, I was starting high school golf, playing some big junior tournaments, and was playing well, but didn't really have any like finishes I know I could go home and celebrate. What kind of stood out was in April, I won my state championship, which we have a pretty stiff classification. And and then I didn't really have anything until that U.S. Open qualifier. I had the first stage of qualifying and played super well there, and then went into final stage. Had been playing really good at home, played well, and qualified. And so that was kind of the moment for me that kind of boosted my confidence, and things kind of started to take off from there.
All right, so driving to the golf course for the sectional qualifier in it was in Atlanta, correct?
Yeah, it was.
What golf course did you play at?
Piedmont Driving Club.
So you're driving to the golf course that day. You're obviously playing some good golf. You get off to, was it a 63? Is that what you shot the first round? Was it,
yep,
was it lower than that? So you shoot 63 in the opening round. You got 18 more holes left to go. At what point did you start to think about, oh my gosh, I have a chance to qualify for the U.S. Open? And how were you able to manage those nerves and be able to continue to play well? Because you went out and what'd you shoot, like 64 or 5 in the second round?
63.
Oh, is that it? Oh, my bad. Pardon me. I clipped you a couple shots. I mean, what, dude? Backing up a 63 is really difficult to do. I mean, how in the zone were you that day? Was it just golf as easy as it's ever been?
Yeah, thankful I didn't have to like come back the next day and play or anything like that. I was just happy I could keep on running. But like we finished the first 18 and I only had like 30 minutes until I teed off again. So like went inside, like down to hamburger as quick as I could and looked at my phone, looked at the leaderboard, and I actually had like a 3-shot lead and they were taking 5 that day, I think. And so I knew if I went and I set my dad and I, we set a goal, it was just under par on each 9. That probably gets it done.
You but did.
I was so nervous starting the second round compared to finishing the second round. Mm-hmm. I knew like backing up a round like that is it's difficult, but I remember on one, I like on the second 18, I like kind of flared a drive and I was like, oh, here we go. it turned out being okay. And then I missed like a 12 footer for birdie. And then 2, I absolutely went for a par 5 and 2 and boned myself like long over green. And I just like pulled out a full swing flop and hit it to like a foot. And I was like, okay, here we go again.
It's just the beginning.
Yeah, it was just clicking.
Well, yeah, obviously you get it going, man. You shoot that 63, qualifier for the US Open. And so this would have been in, let's see, early June. And the USAM is late August. So you have 2 weeks later, you're playing in the US Open. So tell me about the lead up heading into the US Open, what that experience was like at Oakmont. And if correct me if I'm wrong, but you weren't qualified for the USAM via just qualifying for the US Open. Did you still have to go and qualify for the USAM?
So I had a USAM qualifier on the dates, but qualifying for the US Open got me into the USAM.
It did get you in. Okay.
So that was, got it. I was blessed for that to not have to go do some qualifier in Orlando.
Charlie and I were trying to figure that out, but we really couldn't even find it on the Google machine. It wasn't giving us anything. So tell me about Oakmont. How was it?
Yeah, Oakmont was hard. it was like everything that people said about it was true, but it was so much fun. Playing some practice rounds with some cool people. I played 2 practice rounds with Harris. Played like 6 holes with Tony Finau, and Tommy Fleetwood walked with us. And I played the tournament rounds with Chris Goddard to see him.
Oh, he played great
well
too.
Yeah. That stretch in July. That was pretty awesome. And that golf course was so good. It was so hard though.
Man, I tell you, the first time I qualified for a major, this was 2014 in Pinehurst. And Mason, I played 18 holes on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and then I took it light on Wednesday. I played 16 holes instead of 18. I did. So once Thursday got there, I was absolutely worn out and wiped. Did you find yourself to being just as exhausted maybe as I was, or did you actually manage your time a little bit? Because as US Open practice rounds, man, it could be it can be some pretty long days.
Yeah, no, I played 9 holes each day.
Good for you. Good for you.
And Harris kind of was advising me to do that. Like the practice rounds, 9 holes were taking like 3 hours. I was like, I don't even know how people were doing 18 holes. And like if I would go eat lunch, and if I was like iffy about a tee shot, like on Wednesday, I would run out there and hit it a couple times and walk back to the clubhouse. But Oakmont, Harris was like, yeah, these practice rounds are taking way longer than normally do on tour just because people are looking for their balls in the rough so much.
And chipping every single chip shot too.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is, oh gosh, Oakmont was brutal. Like, it was a fun event though to be a part of. All right, so you leave Oakmont, and of course, you know, you can have – it can either go one of 2 ways. Either look at yourself and say, man, I either have a lot to work on, or you look at all the positives and say, man, I really saw myself competing out here one day. You know, my ball flights were similar. I was able to either outdrive guys or hit different shots that maybe they weren't. What exactly were your takeaways from that U.S. Open?
Yeah, no, I felt like I could definitely hang with some of the best players in the world. It wasn't the result I was looking for. Obviously, I want to make the cut and low AM. That's every AM's goal. And it's one of those things I was kicking myself like, oh, I want this shot back. But it's a U.S. Open venue. You're going to get some bad breaks and things like that. I was playing with Chris Goddard up, and we were driving at about the same. And I know he's one of the longer ball hitters on tour. So that was pretty good for the confidence off the tee. And just watching those guys roll the rock and then how they manage their misses. It's pretty crazy.
So taking the experience from the US Open, let's now turn the page to the USAM. When you walked on site for this US Amateur at Olympic Club, did you carry a little bit of that confidence from how well you played at the US Open qualifier and playing in the US Open? And I know you didn't make the cut, but still, you know, you talk about, you know, keeping it up with Chris Goddard and doing some good things out there. Did you show up there with an expectation that, hey, this could be a really big week if I just stay confident and play Mason Howell golf?
Yeah, no, I walked into Olympic Club. I was pretty confident. I come off a little bit of a disappointing U.S. Junior. I had one medalist.
Missed that. Sorry, I skipped an event.
No. I kind of want to skip that one out of my brain too, honestly.
All right, so what happened? I missed it. What was the deal?
I won medalist and then lost in the first round. So
got it. Okay.
That was one of those things that I just moved on to the next. And
was that at Trinity? Is that right?
It was okay. The hottest tournament I've ever played in my life.
Oh man.
Trinity Course in July.
Oh, I can't even imagine. That place had to be not too difficult either. I imagine y'all were making a lot of birdies.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was pretty firm and baked, but yeah, it was just, if you could survive 18 holes, you'd probably get to play well.
Okay. All right. So you're fresh heading into the USAM, right?
Yeah. Didn't have to deal with any of that match play there. And
so you're medalist at US Junior. So this is the opposite of what happened at the USAM. Mm-hmm. You were on the bubble of even making it to match play. So how close was it for you to actually, you know, making it into a playoff situation? I ended up being like 20 for 17. So I guess you were safe on the number, but I imagine you were trying to have three other guys, you know, fall back to where you didn't have to go and do one of these playoffs. So I imagine that experience was pretty interesting.
Yeah, exactly. No, I honestly played fine in stroke play. The rough was thick. I took a lot from what I learned at Oakmont to Olympic, and had a good first round. I shot even on what was playing a little bit of the harder course in the second round. Not so much. Didn't get off to a great start and just kind of fighting all day. And I got to 17 and like pulled an iron shot pretty bad, kind of flubbed a chip, had like 25 feet for par and made it, and then made a 5-footer for par on 18. And that ended up getting me into the playoff.
Oh man. Dude, you're 20 footer away from missing this thing. That's
yeah,
insane.
No. And at the time, like I didn't even think I was going to have to get into a playoff at 3 over. Like I went back to, I was in the morning wave, didn't really know how things were going to shape up. I knew the wind was going to pick up. But yeah, then I suited up at like 7 a.m. the next morning. And par the first playoff hole and figured that'd be enough in a 20 for 17. And Nope, it had to go to one more, then made a bad bogey. And I was like, I'm probably going to another hole. But fortunately, that was enough to
get the 63 seed. Bogey got you through. That's insane. I was actually, it reminds me, one of my former teammates, Stuart Jolly, I actually caddied for him at the country club. And this is all the way back in, gosh, this would have been like somewhere around 2011 or 12 for the US Amateur, the year that Matthew Fitzpatrick won. And he cruised through stroke play, and a similar deal, big, big playoff. And there was plenty of guys that you wanted to try to avoid. And the player that we ended up getting paired against in the first round was Scottie Scheffler. So, I unfortunately lost to, I guess, the caddy matchup. I lost to Scottie's sister that day. So I still, I have that one going for me that, of course, Scottie played great. And I'll never really forget that day because it's kind of before he is who he is now. But exactly. Lost to his sister caddying that day. So just made me remind me of that playoff experience. That can be so awkward.
Part of like the USGA thing is, I guess, since there was only two of us that made bogey, so one of us was going to get the 64 seed and one of us was going to get the 63 seed. But their seeding's random. So it's just one of those things that you just have to hope that you don't run into a buzzsaw.
That's how it goes. So walk me through the whole USAM. You know, was it fairly easy for you throughout the whole time? Was there good golf or tough matches? How would you describe your play all the way up until that finals?
Yeah, no, I definitely didn't make it easy on myself. There were some matches where I felt like I could have played better, but I got the job done. And there were some matches where I needed every shot. I played my round of 64 match against Tommy Morrison, and
we went to start.
19 holes. Yeah, we went to extra holes. I got up and down from long in the green on 18, which That's one place I wasn't supposed to be.
I remember watching that. Now that I think about it, you just kind of cut the legs out from underneath it. Just barely got it on the green. Chicken with that back pin, right?
Yeah, back left pin. I went long. It's one mistake I couldn't make. But anyways, we cruised through that somehow, and then I've got Ben James the next morning.
My goodness, you got two Walker Cuppers you're going right up against right away.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, that match neither of us played great, but we were tied going in 18, and I made par, and that was enough to get me through. And then I played Max Herndeen, I think, in the round of 16, and we had a really good match. There were birdies left and right in that one.
Where's he playing?
He plays at Illinois, and he had beaten Koivin in the morning, so I had the potential to go Tommy, Ben, and Koivin, but
that would have been insane.
But we played well, and then I played Little John, and that was probably my best match of the week.
How did he play? What was the support like for Little John out there? I know.
Yeah, no, he had a lot of support
with his dad, right? I would imagine that probably felt like a little bit like an away game, not maybe quite as much as Neil Donegan, who's had seemed like the entire city out there watching him. So luckily, didn't have to deal with that.
Yeah, you knew where Niles was on the golf course the entire time. No, but Little John had plenty of supporters out there, and we were birdies left and right. And let's see, I went one up on 14, I think, and then we tied 15, 16, and 17. And then 18, we both hit it inside 5 feet for birdie and both made it to end that match. So I won that one up, and just I kept finding myself going to 18, which was not ideal.
Well, you got to find that fairway. If you find the fairway, it becomes a little flip wedge up there by the green. But even some of the best players in the world, if you think about history at Olympic Club, it goes back in my mind. Jim Furyk, one of the most accurate players in the world, finds a fairway, but still found that left bunker and lost himself the U.S. Open, where Webb Simpson ended up winning. So
yeah, that green is tiny.
Yeah, I've never played Olympic. It's definitely on the bucket list, and I'm gonna have to get your Burger Dog review here in a minute. But I've talked to plenty of players that have made it to semifinals of the USAM, Justin Thomas being one of the players. And he said it's almost more nerve-wracking in that semifinals match than it is in the finals match. He's got 36 holes the following day. It's almost a bit of more of a mental grind than it is a physical grind. That semifinal match is just so much on the line. You know, you have a chance to play in the final match, but the Masters is probably the one thing that always comes up for many players. If I can just make it to the finals, traditionally those two guys get invited to play in the Masters.
Yeah, no. That semifinal match, I was very nervous on like that entire day.
As he should have been, man.
I was playing against Eric Lee, and he was getting up and down from everywhere. And so that didn't make it easy, but, yeah, when I won that match, that was like a big weight off my shoulders, and honestly helped me play super free on Sunday.
It seemed like you striped it Sunday.
I mean, I feel like I hit a lot just to the middle of the green, two putts. That's just kind of how Olympic was. Pars were going to win holes out there. So demanding off the tee. But yeah, I hit it great on Sunday and got it done, putted fine, and just played my ball.
I mean, 18 years old, you're still in high school. I think probably heading into the summer, you have all these top amateurs that I'm sure that the Koivins, the Morrisons, the Ben James of the world, these are all the players that, or at least the media would say that these would be the guys that you would expect to win this USAM. And here you are, 18-year-old kid from South Georgia, gets the job done, and all of a sudden you qualify for the Masters, you got the US Open next year, the Open Championship. And then the other thing that probably I'm curious to ask you about was, were you aware too that a Walker Cup spot was on the line for all this? I would imagine that almost slipped through the cracks. Was that something that you thought about at all?
Yeah. So going into the year, absolutely not. I wasn't even close, like off ranking, but I didn't find out until about the quarterfinal match that the winner was going to make it on the Walker Cup team.
Okay. Okay. So you were aware.
Really, yeah. That definitely gave me plenty of incentive on Sunday as well. And being a part of that team that was definitely something I was glad, maybe even more glad I won the AM, because that was so much fun at Cypress.
Okay, yeah. What's tell me about Cypress? I mean, it was just unbelievable. We had Jackson Coivin on recently on the show, and he just was saying how incredible it was. But Charlie kind of came on and said how unique this golf course played. Just felt like it had kind of a linksy vibe to it for being a coastal American golf course. Did it feel like it made you think about how to play as far as just whether shots were on when the ball got onto the ground? I mean, 15, 16 sealed the storyline, of course, with Cypress, yeah. But the rest of the golf course, it seems that you got to find a way to get the ball in the fairway and avoid all the bunkers that are around.
Yeah, absolutely. No, at the beginning of the week, when we first got there, it was super soft and not really what I was expecting. Like, it was 6,600 yards, super soft, super gettable. 6,600
is very short for you guys that crank it.
It was really short. And then as the week went on, it really firmed up. And I would describe the golf course as it split into sixes. It had six holes in the trees, six holes in the dunes, and six holes in the water. And that was what really made it special. It was like three different golf courses in one. But yeah, that was by far my favorite golf course I've ever played. But you had to really think and be creative out there, because there were some shots you found yourself hitting. It was like, I would never be hitting this back at home.
Well, one of the highlights of the week, and this wasn't even during the play. Well, Charlie just gets out to the golf course for the first time, watching. I believe this was the day before you guys got going. This would have been Friday, the day before the matches started. He gets out there. He's like, guys, all caps, Mason Hallett just hold out for two. And so we got this video that I want you to walk us through. Charlie's going to get it pulled up right now and walk us through this 237-yard shot.
Yeah, so we teed off on hole one in a tensum, and then some of us split up. But we still had seven guys in this group, I think. And so the first day that the crowd was out there, and hit a 6-iron from 237, felt good, looked good, and it kind of slammed the flag. It might have been rolling a little fast, but I saw it disappear. Then I saw big 6'9 Tommy's hands go in the air, and I was like, let's go. That actually just happened.
I mean, 237 yards. Remember, this isn't like we're in at elevation for those that are listening. 237 yards with typically a heavier air on the coastline there. You see everybody here wearing sweaters. That's a long way. Did you have some helping wind at least? I'm trying to figure out how a 6-iron could go this far.
Yeah, I was hoping you wouldn't bring it up, but yeah, definitely had a helping wind, and it was pretty firm. It landed. The pin was like 20 paces on, and it landed right on the front. And just took one big bounce and rolled right in.
I think we actually have the sound of Tommy Morrison asking you what club you hit. Let's see if we can roll that in here.
Yeah, Tommy's so funny. Yeah, that was incredible. I was glad I got to do it right in front of Cap too.
talk about Nathan Smith.
Yeah.
All right, what was it like having him as a captain, Nathan?
Hilarious. He's so funny, and he did a really good job. He really knew what he was doing. He's played in so many Walker Cups, and he had all the experience, and we could rely on what he said in the team room. And yeah, he's just such a great guy, and he's hilarious. He really brought good vibes.
The Walker Cup community, for the players that have played, they definitely take a lot of pride in this event. I know there's plenty of players that come back and watch. I know Bobby Wyatt was out there watching one of my players that I used to play with growing up, who made a Walker Cup team, I believe, at National Golf Links. But for that week, you know, when you're in the team room, and I'm sure there was plenty of videos sent to you guys, what stood out of some of the support that y'all got from past players that played in Walker Cups?
Yeah. So we got some videos and from different professionals, but DeChambeau was there on site. He came to watch, and he gave us a hype speech on Saturday after our day. And yeah, it was one hype speech I'll definitely remember. He was on the losing side of a Walker Cup, so we knew. I mean, he's still like it. That stung. He was like, I don't want you guys to feel how I felt on Sunday. So. And then we went. We had a good Sunday morning.
Crushed it, man. Y'all crushed
played
it
well
on
Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, no, hearing his words, and especially for him being on the defeat side of it, because you hear plenty of stories of people winning, and because it's definitely a lopsided event with the Americans winning so many times. But, yeah, he put it in really good perspective for us.
Okay, so I'm sitting here looking at your results, and you went 2-0-1, which is a great record for. I guess you sat out the first morning. Is that right?
I did. I sat out Saturday morning.
Okay, so you sit out Saturday morning. Let's go to the Saturday. This would have been the Saturday singles of, in your match against Luke Potter or Poulter, I should say, Luke Potter, Texas boy. anytime that Charlie pointed the camera at you, good things happened. So here we are at the 15th hole. Charlie's got some more videos we're going to roll with.
Yeah, no, this got it all started for me in the week. I like bringing the energy.
Snap. Go!
Yeah, such a cool hole.
Is that not the best, man?
Yeah, no. That Poulter and I were throwing haymakers at each other all day, but yeah, that putt was awesome to can, because that really got the momentum going for me and really put me in a good spot to win that match. And yeah, it was pretty funny. Every time that Luke made a good putt, Ian was the first one I could hear yell. Every single time. Yeah.
Was it weird kind of going up against a son of a Ryder Cup legend?
Yeah, his last name is Poulter. He's going to be insane at match play. I'm going to have to bring my best stuff.
That's so good. Yeah, he's like, what he was able to do in Ryder Cups is unbelievable. With his timing of making clutch putts, probably one of the best at all time. So to take out Luke Poulter in the Saturday singles, that's great. So let's look at that putt at 16 as well. So you birdie 15, and now here we are at 16. And this is an iconic hole. Can you talk about just closing out a match on this hole?
Yeah, and I hit a good shot in there, and Poulter actually hit one inside of that. But I had Tommy, Michael Assasso, and Koivin sitting up there on the hill. Tommy and Koivin had already finished out his match, and Lasasso and Tommy were sitting out, and that hole's like kind of stretched away from the crowd. And I had to let him know that I made that putt, and to go 2-2 on those two holes in that event was special. And I was just happy to be out there, because sitting Saturday morning and seeing us go down 3-1, I wanted to be out there so bad and put a point up on the board. That was such a special way to play those two holes and to end that match.
You know, that's exactly what any player that ever gets to play Cypress wants to do, is you go in birdie 15 and 16, the 2-2 club. And Michael Assasso told us that this was something that he was unaware of, and him and Ben James did it in back-to-back days in practice. So were you also given some type of memorabilia for going 2-2 on 15 and 16?
Yeah, I have a little coin in my golf bag right now, actually, that for the 2-2 club, and it's got pictures of each of the holes on each side. And yeah, that was super special. And yeah, anything from that golf course in general, and if it's something like that, that's something I'll definitely keep forever.
I mean, dude, you were a highlight reel for the week. We're talking about an albatross on two. You birdie 15, which is an incredible hole to make a birdie on. You close out your match on 16. And now the following morning, so Sunday morning, in a morning in which you really needed to kind of get some momentum back in the foursome style, because the day before, of course, 3-1 GB and I that morning. So this was an important match on the 17th hole that we have Charlie going to roll in. This was just, I mean, come on. What's going on here? 15, 16, 17 to do this?
Yeah. So, I had in this match, I had birdied, or my a partner hit it, Jacob Molesky, hit it to like 30 feet, and I made it again on 15. And we went to 16, and we were three up with three to play, and they chipped in on 16 for birdie. So then we have to go to 17, which thank goodness they chipped in, or else I would have never had this moment. But it's just crazy how that all works. But my partner Jacob poked one out there perfectly in the fairway, and my caddy gave me a number, and he was like, this green typically bounces pretty hard on the front, even though it's kind of a false front.
No, it did.
Yeah, I saw that Koivin and Morrison were on the back of the green in front of me, so I figured theirs took a pretty big bounce. And right as I hit it, you can hear in the video, if it has sound, you can hear my caddy say, great shot. Then we couldn't really see if it went in. We had to look through the rangefinder. He didn't see a ball, so we assumed it went in. And yeah, the place kind of exploded, and we went crazy.
I mean, come on, dude. Can we just talk? Like, you win the USAM, you go to Cypress Point, you make the Walker Cup, and then you have like this type of highlight reel. Could you ever imagine heading into this summer that you would have this many moments? That honestly, I can't even imagine how amazing it is and how cool it is to play those back in your head. I'm sure you've thought about it a lot when you're sitting there in science class about some of these memories.
No, it's it. I just, like the Walker Cup, I never wanted it to end. I could have played that golf course 100 more times before I would have been tired. I was just running off pure adrenaline. But it's one of those things. I was super grateful for the opportunity, especially at the Walker Cup, to play with a group of guys like that, and then at Olympic Club. But you know, to win a tournament like that, you have to have a lot of things go your way. But it's also how you handle the adversity. And I feel like that's been a big part of me growing from junior golf transitioning to great amateur golf is I've grown a lot myself, and I've kind of found that I can hang with these guys. And so just super pumped for what's coming up.
Impressive to watch. And Charlie has been saying that you were a dog, but spelling it Georgia dog, like D-A-W-G's. You definitely showed a lot of dog mentality out there. And Charlie wanted me to ask you too, and he actually brought this up to me in our doc here. It said that your caddy AJ, I guess, qualified for the U.S. Mid-Am. How did he do? Did you keep up with his play?
I did. I keep up with him. I've been texting him back and forth. He was close to making match play. I think he missed it by a couple shots, but I also didn't help. I like took a week off of his golf. Like I don't even know if he got to play all week because he was on the bag for me. So that one might have been on me, AJ. But he's a great player himself. So
that's so good.
I've been keeping in touch with him. He's awesome.
Talk about just the dynamic of all the teammates that you had on this team. Was Sasso the comedian of the entire team? It seems like he kept the energy pretty fun and light the entire week.
Yeah, he's very high energy. he was always had a big smile on his face. And then one person I guess I really didn't get to meet him at the AM just because I played against him was Tommy, and he is hilarious. Just like. Straight face will just say something that'll make all of us die for so long. Like we'll all have food in our mouth and try to keep it in. It's hilarious. It was such a good group of guys. And then Cap will chime in, and then we had Stu with all the experience, and he's not afraid to say something. So,
Stu's my age, man. It's crazy. It's he's become quite the dang player. He was always a good player, but. Him and Nathan Smith, what they've been able to do in the mid-am golf is incredible.
We got to get Stu to stop using that putter from off the greens.
God, that guy, when he lines it up, it just feels like he's going to make it. So, all right, May. So I got one last thing for you as we head out here with this interview. Appreciate your time too. I know you got a pretty busy schedule. You got homework, got all the things you got to do. Busy man. But as you turn the page and as we kind of look towards next year, I want to talk to you about the Masters, the U.S. Open, the Open Championship. Of course, you're heading to school. I guess would this be next year? Where are we right now in the calendar? So you got a whole nother year of high school before you head to University of Georgia the following fall. So, I mean, you got a lot of big things coming. Are you just so pumped to make your way over to Augusta?
Yeah, super pumped. I'm not sure how many times I'll be able to play it before, but going to try to play it as many times as I can. definitely super grateful for that opportunity. And then to play in another U.S. Open, it's going to be super special. I kind of know what to expect now. And to go play some links golf across the pond is also going to be awesome. So, just got to keep things in perspective, keep playing well, keep working hard, and just keep posting good results and just go have fun.
You may know the answer to this, and I'm trying to play it back in my head because every U.S. amateur always gets incredible pairings at the Masters, and I believe the U.S. Open too. Are you going to be playing with Rory next year, like at the Masters?
I think so, and I actually have a pretty funny story about that. I think we'll be paired with Rory if they keep the trend up, and actually in the Tour Championship in 2016 in Atlanta, I went as. Just as a fan, and I was on Sunday on hole four, he flicked me one of his Nike golf balls. It says Roars on the side. I still have it in my room. I kept it. And, Yeah, I might have to play a little joke on him if he splashes.
Does he have no? He doesn't. Did he know it was you?
No. This was back in 2016.
Oh, so this is 2016. Gotcha. Yeah,
I would have been 9 years old. So
that makes me feel old. By the way, 2016. That you were 9 years old. Holy crap! That was my rookie year on the PGA Tour. Yeah. Wow, man. Yeah, it's crazy to see. I mean, at that age, now you're going to be playing with Rory coming off the Grand Slam. Maybe he won't have nearly as much pressure as he's already got that green jacket in his locker.
Tear it up for all I know.
Yeah, but you're playing with Rory. Who would be the other guy that you paired with? Is it randomly?
Yeah, I'm sure it was random. I think it was –
okay.
I looked at the pairing last year just because I was curious.
Yeah, because Biasera played with
– he played with Scotty and JT, I think.
Yeah. Okay. So it'll be a fun pairing regardless. And then all right. So the US Open, you'll play with potentially the US Open champ, or will they go 1, 2, 3 in the world? They'll sometimes like randomly do that.
Yeah. I have no idea how they do that, but, if I got paired with JJ, that'd be awesome too.
It was funny.
I was looking at the leaderboard, when I was teeing off for my first round at the US Open, and he was already in first, and it was just like his week. He was like 4 under through 9, and I was like, dang, I got a tough order in front of me. Chase that.
Well, that'll be fun, man. So you got that on the deck in April. You get the U.S. Open, and then the Open Championship is turning into like one of my favorite majors. That's going to be a Royal Birkdale. Let's not let that one slide. It's one that you're going to enjoy tremendously. The Birkdale, I haven't been there yet, but that's where Jordan Spieth won. And that obviously is going to be an incredible experience. So congrats to you, man. That's quite the accomplishment to go out and do what you've done. Not only just to win these events and play as well as you have, but it seems like you're carrying this confidence with you into next year. So I can't wait to see what else Mason Howell has in store. And I know we're going to see a lot of that dog mentality. So
yeah, exactly. Go Dogs.
All right, buddy. Thanks for joining
us, Mason.
Best of luck to you. See you.
Well, there you have it. Really fun conversation with Mason Howell, one that I'm looking forward to putting that one in the archive, Smiley, and just looking back on it as he plays college golf, as he no doubt gets exemptions into majors. That will not be the last we will hear or see of Mason Howell. So that's a fun one to have him on the show at the ripe age of 18 years old. And here is a more smooth segue than some of the ones we've used at the beginning of this episode. We're going to talk about amateurism now. Something that this was a raging debate that happened while we took our brief hiatus between the Ryder Cup when we kind of resumed a few weeks later after the short paternity leave for you. And so really just to kind of set the table for your thoughts on this, this kind of caught fire during the 2025 US Mid-Am, where I believe 7 of the 8 quarterfinalists had played professional golf at some point in time, 2 of whom logged a combined 154 starts on the Corn Ferry Tour. The eventual winner, Brandon Holtz, he played collegiate basketball at Illinois State before pursuing pro golf. The 2024 winner, Evan Beck, also a reinstated amateur. And then it's interesting too, even coming off the conversation we just had with Mason Howell, where you're looking like Mason Howell's got NIL deals with Ping, FootJoy, Titleist, Holderness and Bourne. Jackson Coivin's got deals with Titleist, FootJoy, Foreside Sports. So you're talking about...
Yeah, what is amateurism now?
What is amateurism anyway? And then I guess the final piece I'd say on this before I kind of pass it to you is the one that really stoked the flames, of course, was Colton Ost saying that he's going to apply for reinstatement as an amateur, as a guy who made more than $4 million. Love Colton Ost. Love the content play, by the way. We're in the content game. This is great content. He made more than $4 million on the PGA Tour, last played a full scheduled season in 2015-16. And his last event he played was the 2020 Waste Management Open. Then, of course, joined CBS a couple years later as a full-time analyst. So before I ask you any specific questions, Smiley, the way these things are going right now, I just want to double check and make sure you don't have any announcement to make regarding your amateur professional status.
If I were to turn amateur again, I would have a list of requests, which is
fair.
Number one, always I need to have a breakfast ball. If I get a breakfast ball and then an opportunity to have enough time to get an airstrike in the middle of the round to make sure I can get the levels back right, then I think I'd consider it.
I love this. I think that's how you submit the application. You're like, here's my credentials. Here's the last time I played a full season. And there's actually, as an addendum, here are my demands. And I think that'll go over really well with the USGA.
Breakfast ball and just an airstrike.
Airstrikes.
Yeah.
man of simple tastes, you know. I could all get behind that. But where's the line for you here?
You made a great point just about how high school kids now or college kids are getting paid. So amateurism has changed. It's changed in college football being the main one. That sport is insane. It feels like semi-pro football now with college golf. Not necessarily being impacted as much, but you see some top players definitely being paid to be able to play at the amateur level. So how does this affect mid-am golf? Because my perception of mid-am golf as a when I was in college or even before that, when it was, you know, it hadn't been around forever. Mid-Am golf, it was established. The Mid-Am was, it feels like that it hasn't been here forever. Am I way off in that? Like Mid-Am is, help me out here. When was it established? Can you do a little Google search?
Yeah. You keep opining while I do a search on,
I guess it does make sense that.
Okay, 1981. How about that?
Yeah, okay. It felt like it was going to be longer than that. At Bell Reef.
That was first U.S. Mid-Am.
I felt like it was longer than that. Anyways, I would say that where we are now is that if you didn't make it to the PGA Tour, I really don't have that big of an issue unless you were like a lifer on the Korn Ferry Tour. To me, it's the question of when did you put in your reinstatement for your amateur status back. I feel like the clock starts whenever when you press that button. Now, for instance, for me, I don't think I've played since 2021, and I don't think my clock should start until I press the button. So as soon as I put in my letter of, hey, I want to be an amateur again, it should be from then. So I should have to wait, let's say it's 7 years from now, instead of the clock being the last tournament I played. That would be the one thing I would say. It's like, okay, I understand things are different now, but that would be one area that I would start in is probably just when the whole clock starts with amateurism.
Well, it's perfect that you brought that piece up, because actually Alan Bassable for golf.com wrote a very helpful article on this topic recently as this debate was raging on. And I'm just going to read you some sections of it to detail the USGA's process, because I think that helps inform the conversation. So according to the USGA, roughly 800 US-based pros, including not only tour professionals, but also club and teaching pros, annually apply for reinstatement, and virtually all of them are approved. Pros who want their AM status back need to only answer a couple dozen questions on an application. Application fees $200. Among the info they got to supply are tours they played on, results, cuts made, prize money won, two people who can attest to the accuracy of the info. The minimum waiting period for a pro seeking reinstatement is 6 months from their last pro action. But more decorated tour pros, the cooling off period can take years. So this is a quote from I don't have the name of the guy who was in the story, but his last name's Winter, and I think he's a senior official with the USGA.
Craig Winter. Quote,
there you go. The more success you have, the more that you would be asked to wait from whenever your last breach was, and the weight that we put on that is, it's hard to just kind of put into words specifically, but if you played on a major tour and had membership, you're going to wait quite a bit longer than someone who played mini tour golf and won cash prizes or prizes above $1,000, the limit in the current rules. The question was posed in this article, has a pro ever been denied reinstatement? Not as far as Craig Winter can tell. They looked back through the archives. No one's ever been denied a reinstatement. So then the hypothetical is posed, what would happen if Scottie Scheffler wanted his amateur status back? And Scheffler falls into what the USGA calls its national prominence category. So in other words, players of large repute. For pros in this class, it's a pretty easy decision. This is, again, a quote from Craig Winter. I'm very confident that Scottie, should he choose to apply or someone in this situation, he'd receive a phone call that would say, Scottie, unfortunately, you fit the national prominence category and you're not eligible. So that's just a series of information there on the way they process these things. But I do think there's a little bit of a nebulous line that's drawn there. And I wonder too, Smiley, what the goal is of pros that are trying to kind of get their amateur status back, right?
Competition, man. Competition.
Competition.
We miss competition. It's as simple as that.
But you know, and I think for some, it's like, what is it, you know, of course it's competition itself, but it's also like, what does that attach you? So in the example of the Mid-Am, that you know, player for you know, the recent history gets an exemption into the Masters, right? So it's got a nice little kind of, you know,
hard character. To win the Mid-Am, but
hard to win the Mid-Am. So, but it's, does the, if it becomes a thing where the Mid-Am is littered with these ex-pros and Augusta National's viewing that as, is this really in the spirit of the way we set up this exemption to award the pure amateur golfer? Like, does that change? I don't know. No, like, you know,
I'm not against the whole thing. I mean, I think it's just the top level. Like, I think the Colt one's obviously like debatable when you've made as much money as he has on the PGA Tour, you know, played as long as he did on the tour. There's going to be people that are upset about that. And I can understand why, you know, from my standpoint, if I wanted to put my amateur status back, I don't think I should be able to get it back because I've won on the PGA Tour. But I also, like, I there's nowhere for me to play golf besides member guests and members where it doesn't even feel right playing in those anyways. And I can't get any starts in PGA Tour events. And I'm I guess you can maybe try to get sponsors invites over to Asia or wherever you can try to get starts. There's just nowhere to play for someone like Colt or I. So I can understand that why Colt would want to try to get his AM status back. If you got to play, you know, by the way, the AM circuit is Mid-AM circuit's fantastic. There's some incredible events, Seminole, Pine Valley,
yeah,
the Mid-AM.
The Crump Cup, yeah, there's a ton
there's
of them.
Some,
yeah.
There's some great events. Sure, I would love to compete and play in a couple of those, but I to think that like Colt or I are playing at that level that we played on the PGA Tour, well, that's not true. We're definitely not getting nearly as many reps. I would say, gosh, I mean, the amount of practice, I haven't done a chalk line since I've stopped playing. So I haven't done a putting drill practically in 4 years. So we're talking like severe. Yeah. Just lack of being able to touch it as much as I did. I don't know where you draw the line. Is it the amount of PGA Tour starts? Mm-hmm. Is it how much money you've made on the PGA Tour? Because I definitely feel like there's a line that crosses for just the general public to be looking at the Mid-Am and be like, hold on. That one's a red flag. And like, I think most people agree that when they see Colt's name in the Mid-Am, they're going to see that. It's not that I don't think that Colt shouldn't be an amateur. It's just that when you've made $4 million, it's just hard to justify it. But I also understand the reason why. Like, he wants to be the Walker Cup captain. He wants to, you know, he's already got a decorated amateur career, which, mm-hmm. I could totally understand wanting to add to that too, because, I think they could pick him to be the Walker Cup captain without the being an AM, but I can understand that they've never had an AM not be the captain. So you could see from that standpoint.
Man, it's so interesting hearing you talk about this, because you know, the line of thought, the proposal that I make is, you know, could you divide it to where there is like a Mid-AM circuit that is retired professionals, and there's a Mid-AM circuit that's just pure true amateurs. But even there, as you're talking about this, it reminds me of another sort of thing that the USGA is embroiled in, the ball rollback. It's like, where does the ball rollback stop, right? Like, if you're playing with a regular ball throughout, you know, through your junior events until you get to high school, and then all of a sudden you're playing, you know, USGA sanctioned events, you have to switch to this ball. It's like, where is the cutoff there? And if I was a retired pro that, you know, maybe just played Corn Ferry Tour, and I did have an affinity for competition and desire to get back out there on an amateur level, robbing me of the ability to play against, you know, pure amateurs that are the best of the best in the game would stink. So it's like, how do you?
But we have full time jobs, man. Like, yeah, like Colt's. I mean, he's got, you know, the podcast. He's got Sirius XM. He's got CBS. So like, he's busy. And like, another example of like outside of Colt, like John Peterson, garage business. Like,
yeah,
played plenty of times on the PGA Tour. Had his card for quite some time. Incredible golfer. A really great amateur career as well. Was a Walker Cup snub. And also had a chance to win the US Open as a pro. And
and almost won as an amateur on the Nationwide Tour, like an incredible player. And he got his amateur status back and almost qualified for the US Open this past year. So like, he's also another player. And then Bobby Wyatt, also a number one amateur in the world at one point, got his PGA Tour card. He's back as an amateur. So it's, there is a cycle of PGA Tour players getting their AM status back. And it does show me that, okay, I technically could do it, but I also, I'm just not there yet. I think the PGA Tour win thing just always sits in the back of my brain because people ask me all the time if I do it. And the PGA Tour win always for me just sticks in the back of my head of like, dude, you're a pro. Like, stay a pro. And I don't know. That's where I'm at.
Is it just that? Like, is it just the shame's not the right word, but just is it just the bad optics around I won on the PGA Tour and now I'm applying for reinstated AM status that would hold you back? Like, I guess
my question, like being a pro. I like the idea of being a pro. You know what?
Okay.
Turning pro was a really cool deal for me. Having success as a pro, failing as a pro, all of it. To me, I enjoyed the experience a ton, and I just value being a professional golfer.
Mm. How much do you miss high leverage competitive golf? Like,
yeah,
a lot.
Uh-huh. I mean, that's what you practice and train for. Any athlete will tell you that when you're in the heat of the moment and you can't feel your arms, can't feel your legs, but you're in this flow state and you don't know how you're able to do what you're doing at such a level. Like, how are you making these 30 foot putts? How are you hitting these high cut seven irons with water on the right side? And you're just sauteing one into the corner of the green. You just know how to do it because you train over and over and over again. That's the part I miss, definitely the competition, but still, I don't put the reps in. Like I told somebody the other day when I was playing, like it takes me to about like the 16th hole sometimes to like get the feeling of how to hit a certain shot, you know, cause I know how to do it, but my body and just the amount of times that I've had an opportunity to rep something, it's just not there. I don't have the reps. And so there's days I play really well. There's days where I'm like, I would like the, as far as like making the mid-AM top 64, like I'd be hanging out with the dudes in the back, man. Like we'd be drinking a beer. Like we're outside the cut by 10. Like there's days where golf is like that for me.
Well, and I wonder, would playing mid-AM golf scratch that itch for you? Or would you rather just do a random mini tour event or something like that? Like, you know, or is it like, hey, just I'm good with not scratching that itch ever again?
I still am not over keeping score and just being defined by a score. I don't think I've played around really. Maybe I can count on my, gosh, maybe four or five different times where I feel like I know what I'm at during the round. Were constantly for years and years and years, all I cared about what I was in relation to par. Over the last four or five, I don't really know where I'm at till the end. And I've programmed my brain to not really care what I'm at. I generally know what I'm at, but it's not like, okay, this putt is to get to six under, or this putt is to stay at even. I just am like, all right, I'm just out here having fun. If I make the putt, great, on to the next hole. And that's where I'm at now with the game of golf. I'm not defined by a score, and I don't think I want to be defined by a score again, because I hated my judgment of the score, hated everybody else's judgment of the score and me. And I hated that at the end. So I'm like, I'm still like inching my way back to feeling like golf and the score and just the overall pressure of just playing the game. You know, all that competition of like, I love the competition, but that aspect, I don't think I'm quite there yet.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. I did not expect this.
Well, I don't keep a handicap. I don't keep a handicap because I don't want anybody going into my thing and be like, hey, what did this guy shoot? I just like, I don't care for people to know what I'm shooting. It's like, I'm out there just like, try to improve the, like improving every single time I play golf is like, that's fun for me.
You know, that's so interesting because that was exactly where I was going to go next, remembering that you'd said that on the show of just what it felt like to maintain a handicap. And I think a lot of that does go hand in hand with the fact that you're a tour winner. Like you're forever, that is how people are going to define you and be able to speak to you in that context and go and look at your gin profile and do all these sorts of things. You're like, I don't care to do that. And I think the latter half of that statement is one that is exceptionally healthy, and one that I connect back to some of the stuff that Scottie Scheffler said at the Open Championship this last summer that everyone, you know, just balked at and thought it was the craziest thing of all time. But like, he doesn't want to win. He doesn't care about winning trophies. Like, no, it's actually quite the opposite. He cares about every single shot, the process that he's going through. Like, he cares about the process of getting better. And if that, at the end of the week, that results in four scores that have him up there at the lowest score of the entire tournament, hoisting a trophy, great, fantastic. He's going to be really happy about that. He's going to celebrate that. But it's the results oriented approach in golf or in life is one that's always going to set you up for a lack of fulfillment. The one that's process oriented is forever going to be the most fulfilling. So I think that's, in a way, it's a beautiful thing to think about it. And it also has absolutely nothing to do about the conversation about reinstating the amateurs we've been having thus far, but an interesting one nonetheless.
Yeah, most certainly. And I mean, it would be a wild journey to see my man Cole getting back to the Masters, like, and this time not turning that thing down. Make yourself at home there at Augusta. Get in the, what's that? What's the cab? Butler. It's not Butler Cabin. What's the?
Yeah, Butler Cabin, right?
No, it's the one with where the amateur, the crow's nest.
Oh, the crow's nest. Yeah. Crow's nest. Yeah. Yeah, that's honestly, listen, if you're in the golf content business, you should be rooting as hard as you can for Cold Nose, because that storyline would be amazing.
I would love it.
Oh, it'd be so good.
The haters would be out in full force. So
good. It would be so good. Be a lot of angry bot Twitter accounts that were like posing as they got some Twitter account that's a spinoff of some random guy's name. I can't stand it. Those people being mad would make me happy. So I love that. Well, there you have it. That was a nice little rundown of amateurism. Got a nice little conversation with Mason Howell.
Yeah,
got to talk a little golf gambling.
Do you remember Omar Uresti?
Oh yeah,
that was the one that always pissed off the PGA professionals, because he got his PGA professional deal. He taught a bunch, kind of like the Michael. He was the Michael Block before Michael Block, and he always qualified for the PGA Championship. Yep. And so it always made the PGA teaching professionals upset. It's like, this guy played on tour for however many years. Like, it's kind of a different debate, because we're talking the USGA versus the PGA. No, but
I think it's the exact same, Smiley, because I think it's one of those things where if you told me there was a mid-am circuit that it's just high level competitive events, right? And yeah, you get to hoist a trophy at the end of the week, but like, really, it's just, there's no exemptions into other tournaments. It's just, you're playing an amateur circuit. I think most pure, true amateurs that never turn pro would be thrilled to show up and play against a Colton Ost or a Smiley Coppin, because how cool is that? This guy teed up on the PGA Tour and I get to test myself against that guy every week. Here's why I think the disconnect happens, or where people get upset, is there is the Masters invitation. There are exemptions into all these different majors that for most people, I mean, you know, it's people teeing up for US Open qualifying. It's like, that's all they care about, it is the end result. It's like, they don't care about, you know, playing against certain people. It's like, I think I can play in the Masters, so I'm going through all these things. I'm trying to do that. For Omar Uresti, I think it's the same thing in a different way. You got a bunch of guys who've been folding shirts all year long, and here's their one tournament where they get a chance to go play in a major, the PGA Championship, and they got to tee up against a guy who's played on the PGA Tour already. So of course that's frustrating in that context. But if it was a different context where they just get a teed up against that guy, and at the end of the week, one of them's hoisting a trophy, I think it would feel a lot cooler. But I think and that's why I say, I'd just be really interested at some point if these sort of reinstatements reached a tipping point where, you know, just theoretically, an Augusta National said, you know what, this isn't in the original intent of why we were handing out the exemption. We were trying to reward pure amateurism. So if they're not doing that,
it would be,
then we're not going to give an exemption.
It would be an Augusta type to, because amateur golf is so important to Augusta National. You've seen it in so many different events that they award invitations to, you know, the Latin American. Yeah. You know, you got the drive, chip, and putt now. I mean, I know that's not a great example, but still, amateur golf and Bobby Jones and the history of that place is definitely in their roots. So yeah, I don't know, man. It's interesting.
It really is, and I think this is what, you know, the last thought I'll provide on this before we've gone well over a lot of time for this episode, but just is that I think this is what makes the game of golf so beautiful, is that there are all these these different sort of intricacies of how we view it and you know, professional versus amateur. And you know, like this whole conversation, while it frustrates many and it gets people arguing, it does kind of illustrate that it's not just as black and white as like there are just these scaled levels of competition. And the better you play, you go up, and then it's it. Like, you know, you start talking about like football, college football. There's not some like storied amateur football, you know, circuit that like is like some guy, like one guy a year gets to go play in the NFL for one game because, you know, so that's what I think is kind of wild and cool about golf. And it's, and here we are debating it. So there we go. That's all I got for you, Smiley.
Me too. That's all I got. I'm out of brain power.
Out of brain power. It's late. We're back on the clock tomorrow morning to wait.
And Brian Kelly's still not the coach at LSU.
Kelly's still not the coach at LSU. Which is the
best part. Can't wait to go on the message board tonight.
Well, if you see it, yeah, you're straight off the message boards. I'm straight off to bed. And yeah, we don't really have a ton to tease for next week, but we will be back here with another new episode and some fun and exciting things. Maybe a fun conversation. If you stuck around this long, thanks for sticking with us. We'll see you soon.
Peace.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes. So I'm happy to come on and shoot the...